This is your James Bond read-along book. Every time you hear this sound, it means it's time to turn the page in your storybook. Now, we are ready to begin the exciting story of You to a Kill.
What?
My brother's in trouble!
How do you know?
I know!
You know those had easy. But now it's gonna get real hard. Cobra's hired evil twin brothers, leaders of the Crimson Guard. They're devil twins, so much the same. If one is in trouble, the other feels pain. The Crimson Guard's the most dangerous foe.
Can G.I. Joe stop the Crimson Guard? Find out in Marvel Comics.
Searching my past for the things that I've seen. Is it my life or just something I dream?
Resume. Noun. 1. A summing up. Summary. 2. A brief written account of personal, educational, and professional qualifications and experience.
After all the personal landmark comics I read in March, I guess I must have taken things a bit easier in April of 1985. I fished a number of comics published this month from the bins of Marauder Books, which is one of my early regular shops nestled in a strip mall married to a grocery store. That was in 1989, though, so I'm not prepared to fully count them for the purposes of this project. Still, I'd like to give shoutouts to Legion of Substitute Heroes Special Number 1, which was mildly amusing, but fell far short of the standard set by their Ambush Bug collaboration. Tales of the Teen Titans Number 55, benefiting from Deathstroke's final confrontation with Changeling over the death of Terra, as well as my being too young to understand the sexual politics of blaming a 14-year-old girl in a relationship with a middle-aged man, and the new Teen Titans Deluxe format number 10, involving Jericho, Cole, Azrael, Tamaranians, and so many other lousy elements of the period that even Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, praise be his name, couldn't gin up my interest. I want to say new Teen Titans number 10 was in the grocery sack of comics in 1988, but I might have gotten it out of the quarter bin at Marauder Books. Titled Ghost Story, with Alcala indebted art by Stan Walsh, it was a deservedly rare attempt at having a colorful young super team involved in a supernatural murder mystery better suited to an episode of Medium. I feel the need to also spotlight Grimjack number 13, the first installment of the book I paid full price for as a back issue at Marauder. I'd fished Grimjack number 8 out of the bin previously and hated the lead, but I got enough laughs out of the Munden's Bar backup to give it another try. As it turned out, I hated 98% of all other Munden stories, but ended up collecting the entire run of Grimjack from 13 as my gateway. Still, that's 4 years from what we're covering today. G.I. Joe, Real American Hero number 37, had a cover with a solid layout, but not as iconic as most Mike Zeck pieces from the series. His A-game wasn't necessary, thanks to Hasbro's scheme to release animated commercials for the Marvel Comics adaptation of their property to skirt regulations against their advertising their toys directly. Leatherneck battling the Crimson Twins, Tomax, and Zaymot at an amusement park with the Crimson Guard in tow got all the action in the spot. Weirdly, the part that stuck with me was a cute girl in a bongo bear costume having her yellow polka dot van full of balloons commandeered by the Joes. I blame the bland Frank Springer interiors, making the absurdity stick where the fisticuffs didn't. My brother had all four referenced figures, but none of them were favorites either. I don't think they ever made a bongo.
Is everything all right in here?
Yes, ma'am.
I grew up on the colorful puppets of Sesame Street and the Muppets, having mentioned in a previous podcast that one of the first things I ever read was The Monster at the End of This Book, starring lovable, furry old Grover. My grandmother loved to recall the story of how a tug-of-war with a bully had torn my precious Ernie doll in half, and how she crudely mended Ernie for a few more years of love. I caught much of The Muppet Show in first run on ABC, and what I missed I likely saw in syndication on Houston's UHF Channel 39. All the biggest stars of the era guest starred, and their appearances are still memed today. I'm confident that I saw The Muppet movie movie theatrically in 1979, and many times afterwards on ABC affiliate VHF Channel 13's Million Dollar Movie. I've been known to occasionally break into a rendition of The Rainbow Connection in my best Kermit the Frog voice. I also caught the presumptuously named The Great Muppet Caper in 1981, and slightly more appealing The Muppets Take Manhattan in 1984, before my interest began to wane. While I understand that The Muppet Christmas Carol is a millennial holiday favorite, the only Muppet movie I could ever muster a portion of enthusiasm for, after the first one, was the 2011 reboot. And even then, I've never seen the whole thing. There's been multiple passes of returning The Muppets to primetime television, but the formula's never been right, and things only got worse after Jim Henson's passing and the brand's acquisition by Disney. The last theatrical experience for me, Muppets Take Manhattan, featured a dream sequence in which the painfully awful Miss Piggy imagined what it would have been like to have grown up with Kermit. Seeing as the original Muppet movie depicted how the main cast had come together as adults, Manhattan arrived only 2 months ahead of the Muppet Babies cartoon series on CBS, making it clear that the tail was wagging the dog on that one. But it's salvaged by the Muppet Babies being a contender for best entry in the Henson library. Not even the Muppet Show was as consistently entertaining and inventive as the Marvel Studios cartoon, which not only allowed for more elaborate pop culture parodies than the felt puppets, but even incorporated footage from their targets in a live-action animated precursor to Who Framed Roger Rabbit. Well, in truth, it had more in common with the racy early HBO sitcom Dream On, with the file footage used often but briefly to make a point in the current narrative, without much in the way of actual interaction. Still, it stood out on Saturday morning, and I somehow managed to get up early enough to watch fairly regularly. Muppet Babies was an enormous success, running 8 seasons and spawning a cottage industry of toddler versions of established IP refreshing various brands. All this is to say that I bought Muppet Babies number 2, a Star Wars parody, either off the stands or in a 3-pack. Written by Stan Kay and drawn by Marie Severin, it was fairly on model for the show, but it didn't grab me in the same way, so I didn't come back for more. I wasn't certain if I read it until I flipped through a copy and recognized a few key elements. Aside from not being memorable, the confusion likely stemmed from the cover art having been recycled for Star Comics subscription ads. Speaking of babies, Uncanny X-Men number 192 had a striking Bill Sienkiewicz image of Wolverine threatening to skewer a member of Power Pack, but it had an aversion to non-Muppet kid groups. I passed on it individually and as a 3-pack, finally reading my half-brother's copy years later. In fact, I missed pretty much everything until number 200, and caught up using his copies, or even waiting a decade for X-Men classic reprints. I don't know why. In a reversal of my odd fascination with Al Milgram's Spectacular Spider-Man, I recall making the conscious choice to avoid Secret Wars 2, despite my enjoyment of the first volume. Perhaps it was the disparity between John Byrne's cover image and the interiors, inked by Steve Lee Aloha in an ill-considered hybrid with Milgram that recalls the off-pairing of Staton and Gibson on Millennium. Also like Millennium, there were far too many tie-ins, causing me to skip titles rather than add them to my purchases. The Beyond Human Form looked too doofy for my taste. Al Milgram was way not Zack or Layton in handling hordes of heroes, and it just plain looked bad. And by most accounts, looks were not deceiving. I thumbed through my half-brother's copies when we started having a relationship a year or two later, but never properly read this series. Similarly, I recall John Byrne's cover to Rawhide Kid number 1 when it hit the stands and wondering, why'd he do this? Sectors number 2 and 4 were missed on first pass, but found their way in my hands by unknown means later in the decade. Again, I think the book was too convoluted and dialogue heavy to hold my interest. Blue Devil number 14 was solid, and I'll confess that the first time I saw Robin's debut cover on Detective Comics number 38 years down the line, it reminded me of Kid Devil. That's kind of wrong. Rick Magyar worked surprisingly well over Alan Kupperberg, elevating his game, but it's still tough having to follow Cullens and Martin on the cover. Dreadstar and Company number 2 landed in a weird place between Close to Home and Afternoon Special with his tale of Willow's troubled young life, but the story was strong overall, and I adored the artwork. This was my book, and I cherished it. Finally, I'd yet to make the acquaintance of Ambush Bug in 1985, but I sought the second issue of his debut miniseries as full price backstock at the Third Planet Satellite store a year or two later. So I'm counting Qantas, the koala who walks like a man. This one was slightly more conventional than the debut, but only just, with tangents like the Ambush Bug guide to collecting comics, and ending with Darkseid serving McDonald's years before Wonder Woman's turn at Taco Bell. This was obviously a gas. We did not have cable in 1985, so I'm not sure when or how we came to see Sam Raimi's Forgotten Misfire Crime Wave. Possibly I botched a video rental, but this still feels like something stumbled upon rather than chosen. On the other hand, I'm confident that we saw Stephen King's Cat's Eye on VHS, probably an EP recorded off HBO by a family friend with a couple of other movies. I was still trepidatiously tiptoeing into horror, and aside from an implied decapitation, this was set the right level for someone with a low tolerance threshold. It had Drew Barrymore from E.T. and Firestarter in a bridging device between anthology stories featuring James Woods from Videodrome and Robert Hayes from Airplane and the time-stopping Watch movies. Plus, it starred a house cat and involved a breath-stealing goblin. Well, it's not the light. The only theatrical viewing from more or less this month was Lady Hawk, Richard Donner's underappreciated fantasy flop that probably reintroduced me to Matthew Broderick after his more anonymous turn in War Games. I'd actually seen Michelle Pfeiffer in several movies at this point, including The Hollywood Nights, Charlie Chan and the Curse of the Dragon Queen, and Scarface, but she hadn't made an impression before End of the Night with Jeff Goldblum. I'm not confident that I connected the actress between Night and Lady Hawk, but I never would overlook her again. I hadn't yet seen Blade Runner, and at best grazed his role in Nighthawks, so this is where I first took note of Rutger Hauer. I was impressed with all three leads, and followed them to other features after this romantic fable. I haven't seen it in ages, but my mother would pull out her tape routinely enough that I have accumulated multiple additional views by osmosis. On to May, and more importantly, the first progress made on writing comic reader resume in over 9 years. Yes, folks, the podcast version has finally overtaken the original blog incarnation of this feature. So Storm Shadow staring down the barrel of Destro's Luger on the cover of G.I. Joe, Real American Hero number 38, was one of Zek's easier gigs, but certainly made an impression. I had the original Destro figure, and almost immediately broke off one of his arms in a terrible parachuting failure. Even maimed, some other kid thought he was cool enough to steal from me. I loved that Destro deeply, but too briefly. I never had the original Storm Shadow, but played with a few kids who did. Good for them, my fingers weren't as sticky as theirs. A few years later, I got the second heroic Storm Shadow with the hood, and I think he lasted less time in my clean hands than Destro. Tossing through this one, I'm not certain of its status in my collection. I may have read a friend's copy, or just the synopsis in a yearbook. Number 39 had an old-timer cover featuring Stalker in the Bush, and I almost bought it in a 3-pack, but it never made it home with me. Winnie and Richard Penny's 1978 small press series ElfQuest began Standard Comics format, full color reprints on the newsstand with a new cover and number one branding. They had been a modest hit for several years, but like Dreadstar and Company, Marvel was repurposing its epic imprint to offer direct market material to a broader audience. I still had a taste for fantasy back then, and perhaps an Ewok itched to scratch. So I actually stuck with this title for a little bit, continuing into June's number two. My best guess on Fantastic Four number 281 was that I was either drawn to the ominous cover of Sue Storm Richards in a sexy evil witch costume, or it just came out of a 3-pack. Maybe both. There's a slim chance that the Daredevil guest appearance could have been a factor, but I still wasn't super into the Man Without Fear yet. He's so tiny on the cover. In fact, I'd forgotten he was even in that issue. This is a rather spooky story involving Psycho Man giving Sue the alternate identity of Malice and causing citywide riots to erupt. It also had inks by Jerry Ordway, which gave the usually fun John Byrne a greater grounding in a harsh reality. Aside from the horror and BDSM elements, the story didn't make a big impression on me, and it was followed by several Secret Wars 2 tie-ins. I stayed away for a while. Renegade's Mistree 3D number 1 got fished out of the Marauder Books quarter bin in 89, along with several issues of Mistree's thrilling detective adventures from Eclipse Comics. I liked her neo-noir tale of a widow avenging her husband's murder, as well as the short Mike Mist's one-minute mysteries that filled out the issues. Still, I was never compelled to seek out further issues at full price, even after DC Comics briefly picked up the property. Kupperberg and Rick Nagyar were back for Blue Devil number 15, but the King Kong cover wasn't the selling point DC might have thought it was. And Werner's Vanquisher as the villain signaled that the book's heyday was well over. Who's Who, the definitive directory of the DC Universe, Volume 6, was the only issue of the entire reference material catalog that I ever bought new, from the fancy tinted spinner rack at B. Dalton Booksellers in Alameda Mall. Preceding Ambush Bug number 3 in my personal chronology, this was the first nail in the coffin of my interest in DC continuity until well into the 1990s. I'd only experienced one issue of the official handbook of the Marvel Universe by that point, but it had the regimentation and broad Bronze Age style guide consistency, coupled with the deep text that I craved. The art on Who's Who was all over the place. The yellow dot patterns and garish colors read as childish, and the text was minimal. The less said about all the Omega Men, New Gods, and three-eyed Pinkfish Finn Despero, the better. Obviously, I'd reevaluate this opinion eventually, but in the moment, I was put right off for the foreseeable future. I myself did not possess a third eye to enable a more expansive view. The debut issue of Dreadstar and Company had offered a lengthy summary of the Metamorphosis Odyssey, and strongly recalled my beloved Warlock issues and nostalgic Captain Marvel ones. Number 2 had offered heavy topical melodrama and dark adult themes that intrigued me. The third issue, Holocaust, solidified it as an early favorite with its timely look at nuclear devastation within a marginally comforting sci-fi fantasy lens. The action was intense, the stakes high, and the consequences grave. Month by month, more and more, Dreadstar and Company had become the only book that mattered. Admittedly, this was the peak of its personal relevance, but the first dozen issues remain among my favorite runs of a comic book Again, I bought the entire Ambush Bug miniseries as back issues from the Passing of Third Planet location sometime in 1986 or early 87. This included the Ambush Bug history of the DC Universe in issue number 3, which possibly informed my aversion to DC continuity. This was a cursive handwritten account of the least desirable elements written out of Crisis on Infinite Earths, with an unhealthy emphasis on bat hounds, wonder tots, magical imps, and racial caricatures with prehensile Fu Manchu mustaches. Thanks to its density, it's impossible to remember all the jokes, so it represents the greatest replay value in an already swell miniseries. Props to letterer extraordinaire John Costanza for all that extra effort. Light on the television front going into summer reruns, the Nickelodeon talk/remote segment show Out of Control ended around this time, but I'd seen it more in reruns both before and after 1985 rather than during its run. Dave Coulier of Full House and Alanis Morissette's Nails Running Down His Back fame was the corny host with the "cut it out" catchphrase. I preferred the grumpy animated character that he would occasionally tangle with, sunny co-host Joe Wakewood, and even the colorful weirdo Diz McNally. In another odd children's television connection, it looks like Dawn of the Dead's Marty Schiff was also involved in this production. I recall watching the close of this season of Dynasty, featuring the infamous Moldavian Massacre, where most of the cast appeared to be gunned down at a wedding by terrorists. Oh, you 80s soap operas. Another mix of viewing experiences for movies initially released in May of 1985. Actually, in the case of Fletch, I never did see the film, but somehow ended up with a copy of the seemingly omnipresent movie poster in which Chevy Chase unfurls a wallet full of false identification deployed in his role as a reporter. In the late 70s and early 80s, I saw a lot of Chevy Chase movies in theaters and on television, including Foul Play, Oh Heavenly Dog, Seems Like Old Times, Under the Rainbow, and Deal of the Century. My mom was a Goldie Hawn fan, which would account for some of these, but it seemed like once my stepfather was in the picture, we stopped supporting Chevy. I liked him fine at the time, but when I did see his pictures after this point, I liked him less and less. Based on reputation, maybe I started picking up on his vibe as a louse. Another film I didn't see for a long time after it already had an impact on me was A View to a Kill. It was the first James Bond movie that my immediate family had skipped, and we would never see another together. I didn't break the streak for myself until I saw GoldenEye with Mac over a decade later. However, I have always been fond of the Duran Duran tune, and I read a Choose Your Own Adventure style book that laid out the basic plot and an awful lot of unique variations. I'm not certain, but there may have even been a book and record recording in there somewhere, sadly missing the opportunity to present Christopher Walken to the youngins. I distinctly recall an Entertainment Tonight segment on the film, which may or may not have offered a detailed critique of Roger Moore's advanced age being inappropriate to the role, especially when it came to his leading ladies. It took several years for me to see a Rambo movie. I was never that into Sylvester Stallone, who has his own problematic history, but eventually did get a lot more exposure. Anyway, I bring it up because Rambo First Blood Part 2 was such a cultural phenomenon, I was very aware of it even without actually putting eyeballs on it. It's just that, in this period, my preferred Republican still fighting the war America thought lost was Braddock, though neither were exactly favorites overall. As for movies I actually saw reasonably close to the release date, I'm not confident whether any of them were theatrical, cable, or video. Gotcha offered Anthony Edwards as a college student drawn into a spy game by femme fatale Linda Fiorentino. I used Edwards' character as my stand-in for branding on the Father and Sons sci-fi podcast Bonding Agents, with my father more accurately represented by Adam West. The dumb earworm theme song's chorus still gets stuck in my head. Rustler's Rhapsody was a western parody with Tom Berenger as a singing cowboy forced into a spaghetti western, whose shooting skills were compromised by his not being a confident heterosexual. Don't get your hopes up about representation. He's shaken by his virginity, not his orientation. Finally, Brewster's Millions, the seventh film adaptation of a 1902 story about a distant relative given the chance to inherit a huge fortune, if only he can successfully waste a small one completely and without help or confidants. This one starred Richard Pryor and John Candy, but wasn't exactly funny, so it flopped at the box office. However, one element really struck with me, the creation of a room I could die in by a team of designers. Toward the end of the picture, they finally accomplished Brewster's goal with the room, only to note, I wish you could afford to keep it, and immediately stripping it away, as he appears to be broke. That spoke to me about the ephemeral nature of goals and life itself. At several points, I found myself briefly satisfied that I felt like I could die at that moment reasonably happy, but it swiftly passes as the next directive takes hold. Most specifically, when I closed my comic shop and we finally got every scrap of our stuff out of the strip center, I felt like Brewster standing in that empty space in the baseball uniform he'd been found in at the beginning of the picture. I'd spent 8 years getting to the same place where I'd more or less started, enriched more by wisdom gained than any material compensation, and I was okay with that. Play spies in the dark. finishing out the second quarter with June and Wibbly Wobbly Timey Wimey. Longshot number one made a huge impact on me when I first saw it, possibly on a newsstand, but more probably when I got to read my brother's copy sometime in 1986. Based on Mike's Amazing World of Comics and cover dates, it seems like the book shipped on time, but my perception was that of long gaps between issues. Except I don't think I start hanging out with my half-brother in 1985, and the last issue ships in October, and I never buy a single one myself. Regardless, no comic before had ever been this detailed, with barely contained palpable energy, while also being extremely dark and quirky, thanks to the major writing debut of Ann Nesenti. Two extraordinary talents introduced to readers at the same time, along with a new heroic character who never quite comes across outside of this miniseries, despite a fairly long run in the X-Men during their undisputed sales prime. My brother also collected Rick Veitch's The One with Number One, which I guarantee waited until 1987 or later to pass my way, and which I never came to understand. The Loser Special Number One must have been in the grocery sack of comics, unless I gave it a good hard look in the Marauder Books quarter bin, because there's no way I paid for that stale Hunt, Glansman, Esposito art. Anyway, this was the collection of floundering World War II strip characters that are united as a team and then killed off in a half-hearted crisis tie-in. Macho Man Robert Kanigher kept out the superheroic elements but retained the general fatalism by killing the heroes off unmasked by the end. This was, of course, before Darwin Cook popularized the losers by killing them in a more comic booky way a quarter century later in The New Frontier. I want to say I got Fist of Khonshu, Moon Knight number 4, in a 3-pack, but maybe it was the sack or quarter bin. All I know is that it had my boy Danny Bolandi inking Chris Warner on a Bluebeard wife-chopping riff, and that I will never be okay with this brief period where Moon Knight adopted bling and had visible facial features like the Spectre. It just disturbs me somehow. The third wave of the Superpowers collection hit the discount bins pretty hard. I want to say to the tune of $1.50 each, right in the sweet spot between American Defense and G.I. Joe. I, for one, bought Martian Manhunter, my personal favorite sculpt of the line, and my eventual blogging obsession. The figure included the first semi-solo comic story to cross my path, the 14th mini-comic in a series packaged with the toys, and he was joined by number 15, Dr. Fate, and number 19, Darkseid. Fate didn't last long in my hands on account of theft or loss, but I well remember his cape and shiny helm. For the Lord of Apocalypse, I showed my first girlfriend the Omega Effect by catching the sun at the end of an apartment balcony. I'm pretty sure I also bought number 22, Parademon, but I'm less confident about number 18, Green Arrow, though both figures definitely were in my possession at one time. Back to proper comics, Marlowe was looking good on the cover of Blue Devil number 16, but it continued a storyline that I was not digging. And it just occurred to me that my dislike of Vanquisher's distorted anatomy may have biased me against the Ultraverse's prime as well. The art even anticipates Bray Fogle at times. Dreadstar and Company number 4 couldn't compete with the prior issue in scale, but it otherwise held its own with a tale of palace intrigue and a stealth assassin. The art is gorgeous, the character's fantastic, and remains the only comic book I wait for with bated breath in this time. I wasn't bothering with X-Men, but I am bothered by the reception that this book is coming out quarterly rather than monthly. I anticipate it that much. I get panicked and fearful over the prospect of missing an issue. One last pass at Ambush Bug with its darker-themed fourth issue finale featuring Scabbard, the ashtray that sauntered like a serial killer. Simultaneously hella cool and dumb as dirt, the thriller reject makes way halfway through for the truly momentous villainous debut of Arg Isle, the sock that yada-de-yada. Plus a gratuitous Starfire pinup to remind everyone that Keith can still draw hot babes when he applies himself and his discarded Perez influence. Last round loosely stumbling into the summer season, by this time Mama and I had shared our final first-run episode of The Jeffersons. I've never seen Perfect nor finished St. Elmo's Fire, but the Taichiro themes of both were on my cassette tape of faithful session player recreations of movie hits. Return to Oz waited until cable or video, but I well remember the media hubbub over the disturbing imagery and dark tone taken with a sequel to a beloved musical. I'd seen The Wiz theatrically, which had some odd imagery at times, but Return was nightmare fuel for many of my generation. I might have seen Daryl at the Dollar Show, or maybe a home viewing. The small wonder predecessor robot boy does not linger in my memories a fraction as much as Vicky. I want to say I caught Secret Admirer at the drive-in, but I'm probably mixing it up with My Bodyguard or My Tutor. We'd always attended Gulfgate Drive-In, which was demolished by Hurricane Alicia in 1983, prompting a years-long change to the still-standing marquee announcing Gone with the Wind. Despite appearances by C. Thomas Howell, Lori Loughlin, Kerry Preston, Fred Ward, D. Wallace Stone, Casey Schmatzko, Corey Haim, and Courtney Gaines, I only remember this one just enough to know I saw it some way, sometime, once and never again. Must have been as basic as they come. There's a slim chance I saw Cocoon and or Pale Rider theatrically, but I suspect it's more likely we watched a Friends cable recording on VHS. I knew Steve Guttenberg from Police Academy and many of the aging character actors from similarly raunchy comedies, so a bittersweet dramedy about benevolent aliens and quality of life concerns was not entirely what I was expecting. I quite liked Cocoon, and probably extended to the sequel, but haven't felt a particular need to revisit it in decades. Meanwhile, Pale Rider was a quasi-sequel to High Plains Drifter, and or the greater Sergio Leone catalog. Unfortunately, Clint Eastwood was feeling melancholy and even a little saccharine, so his Great Western revival would have to wait until A Unforgiven. The one unquestionable theatrical experience was Richard Donner's triumphant The Goonies, though don't ask me how he directed two films released in the same quarter. People can and should speak of the kiddie adventure flick in the same breath as Back to the Future, another formative Generation X feature that did boffo box office later that summer. Spoiler for next episode, but I don't think I saw Back to the Future theatrically, so Goonies probably had more time to take up real estate in my brain than it had for most kids. It was great fun with a distinctive voice, but also I kind of grew out of Goonies by the 90s. I've enjoyed the bits and pieces I've caught on cable since, but in the absence of a second generation of Diablo Frank, I haven't had much impetus to take it in full, and the world breathed a sigh of relief. Who wants to see our resume? 21st Century Boys, Dr. Ange, Between the Pages, Billet Spy Vinyl, Chris at Bad Books for Beginners, Chris Dunford, Chris Leiden, Coffee and Comics, Doc Strange, Donnellan Washington, Massachusetts Conversations, John Jennings, Ed Moore, History of Comics on Film, Paul Hicks, Iowa's Joe Is, Irredeemable Shag, Jeffrey Brown, Jocelyn Johnson, Kenny Crady Jr., Marvel Universe Online Project, Randy Caldwell, Surrender Artwork, Siskoid, Spawner, Superbound, Tim Price the Podcrasher, Tom at Cherry Goat, Wayne Burrow, and Wonder Woman Warrior for Peace. Searching my mind for some truth to reveal.